Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome to this presentation of the half-year result for Infigen Energy for the 6 months ended 31 December 2013. I'm Miles George, the Managing Director of Infigen, and joining me today to present the result is Chris Bavistock, our CFO. The agenda for this presentation is set out on slide two of the pack released with our result. I'll briefly address the key outcomes outlined in the early slides, followed by Chris, who will present the group's financial performance, and then I will address the operational performance in the U.S. and Australia. I'll also provide a brief update on the regulatory and market environment and the outlook for the business. We'll then open the line for questions. Turning then to slide three, regrettably, our long-term injury frequency rate, safety performance on a rolling 12-month basis was 3.4, following three incidences recorded over the calendar year. These incidences serve as a reminder that we must remain ever vigilant when it comes to safety. Production was up 4% to 2,242 GWh, and both turbine and site availability were improved. Revenue was up 11% to $149.3 million as a result of increased Australian production and favourable foreign exchange movements. Operating costs were up 8% to $59.2 million. Operating costs were lower in the US and higher in Australia, and the FX movement that benefited revenue had an adverse effect on costs when reported in Australian dollar terms. The higher costs in Australia were largely due to incentive payments to service and maintenance providers for exceeding availability and production targets. Infigen also benefited from higher revenue through those achievements. Corporate development and other costs and other income were up $2.4 million on a net basis, largely due to higher development expenses on attractive US opportunities, and because the prior corresponding period included income related to an insurance recovery that partially offset the expenses. Chris will cover off the financing line items and institutional equity partnerships in more detail, but I will just mention that we recorded a significant item expense of $16.8 million in relation to two interest rate swap terminations due to counterparties exercising their early termination rights. We had previously foreshadowed the likelihood of this outcome. The reported net loss of $15.3 million after taking into account the $16.8 million swap terminations, was an improvement of $12.5 million, or 45%. Net operating cash flow was down 11% to $20.5 million after swap terminations, but up $14.3 million before the swap termination costs. Turning to slide four, total production was up 4%, reflecting better wind conditions in Australia, offset by unfavourable wind conditions in the US. Revenue was $149.3 million, up 11%, reflecting higher Australian revenue and a depreciation of the Australian dollar against the US dollar, partially offset by lower US revenue. Higher production and higher South Australian merchant electricity prices and higher merchant electricity and REC prices in the US were partially offset by lower Australian LGC prices and lower compensated revenue in Australia and also lower production in the US. Operating costs increased 8% in absolute terms, reflecting high turbine O&M costs in the US and Australia and adverse FX movements, partially offset by lower asset management and other direct costs in the US. The increased turbine O&M costs in Australia were largely due to performance incentive payments to the O&M providers. EBITDA was 11% higher at $70.9 million. The combined effect of all the items above and some temporary working capital outflows that Chris will discuss resulted in a net operating cash flow result of $20.5 million, down 11% compared to the PCP, noting again that this period included $16.8 million of interest rate swap termination costs. I'll now hand over to Chris Bavistock, our CFO, to discuss the group's financial performance.
Thanks, Miles. By way of lead-in, slide six sets out the summary statutory P&L and associated metrics. following the change in accounting standards which precludes the use of the proportional consolidation method previously employed, we have restated the PCP as required. A detailed reconciliation, including the previously stated numbers, is included within the financial statements. On to slide 7. This bridges the statutory view to economic interest. As a result of the accounting standard changes just mentioned, this is slightly different to prior presentations. The reconciliation first involves eliminating the non-controlling interest in two USA wind farms, where our Class B controlling interest exceeds 50% and is less than 100%, and then grossing back up each P&L line item for the 7 joint ventures that were accounted for using the equity method. While Infigen naturally continues to prepare the group's financial statements on a fully IFRS-compliant basis, we remain of the view that an economic interest or proportionally consolidated perspective is the most meaningful one and reflects the way in which the group internally manages its financials, as is apparent from our segment information disclosure in our consolidated financial statements in Note 2. From here on, the presentation for all financials will be on an economic interest basis. As for other results briefings, I would also draw your attention to our management discussion and analysis, MD&A, which supplements this presentation. Slide 8 sets out the summary economic interest P&L and associated metrics for H1 FY13 and the PCP. So that should be 14. The main period on period drivers will be examined in subsequent slides. Below the EBITDA level, the principal observations are: net borrowing costs were 38 million, down 8%, or 3.1 million, reflecting lower interest expense due to lower average debt during the period and lower decommissioning provision related costs, partially offset by lower interest income, FX, and higher amortization of loan fees. Net foreign exchange loss of 1.3 million, unrealized, primarily arose due to USD and Euro denominated debt held in Australian companies. This compares with a 5.4 million loss in the PCP following the closeout of foreign exchange hedging contracts. The 0.6 million benefit associated with the interest rate derivative on one slot that is not hedge accounted. Net income from US IEPs was 28 million, up 16.9 million compared with the PCP, primarily due to the unwind of benefits deferred. An explanation of the structure of IEPs, including the accounting treatment, is provided in Appendix B of the full year management FY13 management discussion and analysis. As Miles explained earlier, the termination of two interest rate swaps resulted in an expense of 16.8 million and was recorded in significant items. As a result of hedge accounting, this item had already been reflected in security holders' equity in prior periods. Income tax benefit was 3.7 million compared with 2.5 million in the PCP and is broadly consistent with the loss before tax for the period. The 1.2 million variance being primarily attributable to the higher US losses in the PCP, for which tax benefits were not recognised due to the uncertainty of recoverability. Turning to slide 9, this sets out the revenue bridge or waterfall chart from H1 FY13 to H1 FY14. The principal features were: higher production in Australia was partially offset by lower production in the US. Both regions benefited from higher electricity prices period on period. The LGC price in Australia was slightly below the prior year, with REC prices in the US slightly above the PCP. Compensated revenue, predominantly related to the resolution of an AEMO scheduling error in the PCP, was lower. Finally, the depreciation of the AUD against the USD added 7 million in AUD terms. Slide 10 sets out the operating EBITDA bridge for H1 FY13 to H1 FY14. The first item, revenue, was addressed on the previous slide. Underlying operating costs decreased 1.5 million as a result of the cost-saving initiatives announced in February 2013. These were offset by one-off transaction costs and variable incentive payments to service and maintenance providers for increased production and availability. The FX movement that benefited revenue in AUD terms had the reverse effect on costs. On slide 11, the items set out the waterfall are for the most part self-explanatory. Corporate development and other non-operating costs and income below the operating EBITDA line were 11.1 million for the period compared to 8.7 million in the PCP. Corporate costs were 8 million, up 4% or 0.3 million. This was primarily due to the costs associated with undertaking market testing for the potential sale of Capital Wind Farm, partially offset by lower costs resulting from the cost-saving initiatives. Development costs expensed were $3.1 million, up $1.3 million, primarily reflecting costs of further progressing attractive development opportunities in the US and steady costs in the Australian business. The working capital outflow of $6.2 million is largely attributable to the increased number of LGCs at the balance date accumulated to meet forward sales contracts that were settled in early 2014. Once again, you can see in the table and graph the effect of the swap termination costs on net operating cash flow. Excluding these costs, net operating cash flow was up $14.3 million to $37.3 million. Slide 12 summarises the six-month movement in cash to the end of HY 14, as well as identifying the cash balance held outside the bank group, excluding company cash. Most elements are self-explanatory. The Union Bank facility and existing cash were used to fund the acquisition of the Class A interests. We used cash to amortise the global facility and Woodlawn facility and repay Class A liabilities. And capital expenditure was primarily related to capacitor bank installations at Sweetwater, expenditure related to post-warranty agreements at sites with the Mesa turbines, and development activities. Slide 13 sets out the impact of FX on the P&L and on the principal balance sheet items. The P&L impact can be seen to move from a positive at the EBITDA level to a negative at the before tax level. The balance sheet calculation highlights an unrealised FX cost on translation on our borrowings and Class A IEP balances at balance date. There are also significant unrealised FX movements across other categories of the balance sheet, particularly PP&E and intangibles. Slide 14 gives the balance sheet at 31 December 2013 and June 2013. The principal features are an increase in borrowings due to FX movements and the Union Bank facility drawdown. Interest rate swap terminations and movement in forward interest rates resulted in a $29.7 million reduction to the interest rate derivative liability. The global facility leverage ratio covenant was satisfied for December 2013. This concludes the financial results part of the presentation, and I now hand back to Miles for the operational review.
Thanks, Chris. Turning to slide 16, the US operational performance. A production decrease reflected mixed wind conditions, icing on blades at Sweetwater and lower turbine availability at most wind farms with Gamesa turbines. Site availability improved due to the non-recurrence of scheduled substation maintenance in the prior period. Average portfolio price realised increased marginally due to higher realised electricity and REC prices from merchant wind farms. The revenue decrease reflected a net decrease in production and reduced price at Crescent Ridge following the expiry of its PPA in June 2013. The operating costs decrease reflected lower legal costs following the resolution of the Gamesa dispute and cost savings following the organisation restructure implemented in early 2013. On slide 17, the decrease in asset management cost, including IAM costs, reflected lower legal and IAM costs following resolution of the Gamesa dispute and restructure cost savings. These were partially offset by one-off transaction costs associated with the acquisition of Class A interests. The turbine O&M cost increase reflected the commencement of the Gamesa extended warranty agreement entered into in June 2013. The balance of plant cost increase was due to collection system maintenance at Crescent Ridge and overhead power line maintenance at Cedar Creek, while the other direct costs decrease reflected one-off decrease in transmission fees at Aragon and lower property taxes and insurance expenses at Sweetwater 5 and Cedar Creek. Operating costs reflect a highly contracted turbine warranty and maintenance profile, and further initiatives to reduce exposure to operating cost variability are ongoing. Moving to Australia on slide 18, production increased by 12% to 906 gigawatt hours. The prior period included 27 gigawatt hours of compensated production related to the settlement of an AEMO scheduling error. Excluding this, the variance of 123 gigawatt hours reflected better wind conditions, improved balance of plant reliability and lower network losses, partially offset by less favourable wind conditions at Alinta. Turbine availability and site availability improved by 0.2% and 1% respectively. Revenue increased 11% or $8.5 million to $84.9 million as a result of higher production and higher South Australian electricity prices, offset by lower LGC prices, lower contracted revenue from Sydney Desalination Plant, lower New South Wales electricity prices, and lower compensated revenue. The operating cost increase largely reflected productivity-related incentive payments to turbine O&M providers that were more than offset by the additional revenue generated from exceeding the benchmarks. On slide 19, lower asset management costs resulted from the cost-saving initiatives implemented in early 2013. Higher turbine O&M costs were due to the production and availability-linked incentives and lightning damage repair work at Alinta. There were slightly higher balance of plant equipment costs at Lake Bonnie, and higher inflation-linked land lease and connection costs were offset by lower insurance costs. Energy market costs were lower due to lower hedging costs, lower professional fees, and the cost-saving initiative. Operating costs reflect a fully contracted turbine warranty and maintenance profile, and discussions with service providers to provide post-warranty services at Capital and Woodlawn are continuing. Slide 21 provides a summary of the transaction that we entered into in November to acquire Class A interests in 9 of our US wind farms. I'm not going to go into the detail, which is available in the relevant ASX release from last year. The key aspects of the transaction, however, are that it offers attractive returns on a standalone basis, has a short payback period, and is strategically advantageous in that it begins to smooth the cash flow profile of our US business. Clearly, more transactions of this nature would be required to have a meaningful effect on the refinanceability of the US cash flows, but it is an important step. If we go to the US market and regulatory update, starting on slide 23, while US regulation and market prices have some effect on our business, it is important to note that our US portfolio has 80% of its output contracted, with a remaining weighted average contract duration of 11 years. Independent modelling is indicating some softening in longer-term PJM REC prices, however, forecast REC and electricity prices in other regions, key to us, remain stable. Slide 24 illustrates the continuing strong state-level support for renewables. The state renewable portfolio standards will provide build signals for renewables through to the end of the decade and beyond. The federal investment tax credit for solar development is also in place until December 2016. Tackling climate change has become a more prominent issue in the US recently. President Obama is now using the regulatory power of the executive branch to reduce carbon emissions through bodies such as the EPA, and Secretary of State John Kerry is pursuing a campaign for global action on emissions reductions. Recently, the US and China committed to collaborate through enhanced policy dialogue, including the sharing of information relating to their respective plans to limit greenhouse gas emissions. On slide 25, we've highlighted again the growing opportunity for renewable energy in Australia, driven by the large-scale renewable energy target legislation once regulatory predictability returns. While the graph demonstrates that there is sufficient LGCs to meet demand until 2017, 3 to 4 gigawatts of new capacity will need to be installed between now and then to meet the impending shortfall for that year alone. Beyond that, 1.5 to 2 gigawatts of new capacity per annum will be required to keep pace with the increasing target to 2020. The federal government has released the terms of reference and appointed a panel for the RET review with a mid-2014 completion target. Our submission to that review will focus on the facts, including how the RET has put demonstrable significant downward pressure on wholesale electricity prices, and the independent modelling that has shown that it will continue to do so. The government is keenly aware that significant changes to REC policy that has had long-standing bipartisan support will destroy investor confidence and manifest sovereign risk. It's also aware that the renewable energy target will do the heavy lifting for the government's direct action objectives at no cost to the federal budget. In the meantime, incumbent fossil fuel generators are lobbying forcefully to reduce the RET to achieve higher wholesale prices for their coal-fired generation, whilst admitting there will be no fuel switching to gas without a very high carbon price. Regrettably, the real drivers of electricity price rises, ballooning network costs now and rapidly rising gas costs in the future, have been sidelined for attention. Turning to slide 26, the electricity market is pricing in an expectation of a lower or zero carbon price in FY15, while 2016 forward prices reflect the expectation of higher gas prices as East Coast LNG exports ramp up, although capacity oversupply is suppressing that effect. LGC forwards remain at depressed levels as a result of regulatory uncertainty discussed previously. Prices have softened further to prices not seen since the mid-2000s. Infogen continues to seek to advance its merchant LGC revenue, enhance its merchant LGC revenue through a disciplined contracting approach and inventory management. Finally, on slide 28, we've set out a summary of our outlook for FY14 and beyond. As with the last two quarters, we will continue to provide unaudited quarterly production and revenue outcomes with prior corresponding period comparatives. We maintain the absolute wind farm cost guidance ranges that we provided in August, with the caveat that a continued favourable production performance from Australia will lead to incentive payments to service and maintenance providers. These costs will be more than offset by the associated revenue. Subject to these operating conditions, we are currently on track to exceed our guidance of having $80 million of cash flow available to repay global facility borrowings, distribute cash to US Class A members, and close out interest rate swaps that have already been completed in this half, first half. Cash flow from our investment in Class A interests will also generate additional cash flow to Infogen. Thank you. That concludes the formal presentation for today, and I'd now like to open the line for questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you wish to ask a question, press star 1 on your phone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, press star 2. Once again, to ask a question now, press star 1. Your first question comes from David Leach with UBS. Please go ahead.
Hi, Miles. Thanks for going through all that. Just a couple of quick questions. Firstly, I was just wondering whether the colder winter in the United States had, I noticed you were talking about icing on some blades, had any effect on performance in the last month or two?
David, really only in respect of that particular problem of icing, which creates, you know, operational and safety issues. But apart from that, no.
And secondly, as you mentioned, the REC spot price is down to about $26, I think, at the moment. Is that going to have any impact on your second half income?
Well, yes, it will. As we mentioned, and we've mentioned this previously, we do manage our position with, careful inventory management, and also we also put in place various short-term contract measures to protect our position. So we have some protection, but obviously long periods of low prices will eventually flow through to our revenue.
And as far as those, if we think about how long the you're contracted out, how long will it be before those, if this current price prevails, will that show up in this half to a meaningful extent, or will it be more the next half?
No, it won't show up in this half. The first, in terms of our contracted wind farms, the first one to come off is not for another 12 months or so, which is down at Lake Bonney.
Yeah.
What you'll see is the rest of our merchant portfolio, which is the other two Lake Bonney sites and Woodlawn. As I said, we do put in place some energy markets hedging around that, but over time that will roll off. So there will be some effect in the second half, but it will be ameliorated to some extent by those forwards positions that we've taken.
And costs should be similar in the second half?
Yes, they will be.
And finally, I just wanted to ask a slightly wider question. I think you're the new chairman, are you not, of the CEC?
That's correct.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Do you think that the CEC has got the sufficient firepower and attention to actually make any impact in putting forward the points that you raised about the benefits or, from your perspective of the renewables target?
Look, I think that the Clean Energy Council makes a very significant contribution to the advocacy efforts of our industry, but that is no substitute for individual companies in our industry also getting out there and talking with their local members and talking with the media and talking with anybody who is relevant to this process of the RET review. In order to make sure that our industry is protected from, what is potentially a severe sovereign risk event. So I have, in my capacity as chairman of the CEC, I have certainly encouraged the Clean Energy Council members to get out there and do that, because it is really critical to do that and to do that now. So the short answer to your question is, I think they make a valuable contribution, but they can't do it on their own.
Good. That's all for me. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Thank you. At this time, there are no further questions. Mr. George, please continue.
Okay, we'll keep the line open for a bit longer in case there are any questions. I'll wait a few moments.
Sure, no problem. We now have a question from Jeremy Hicks with ANZ Green Dragon Fund. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. This is Keith Elston. Just a couple of questions to clarify the early termination of interest rate swaps. Can you just give us an idea of what creates an early termination in this case?
Okay, the history is that back in May 2007, we put in place the global debt facility, and at the same time, we put in place a series of swaps to protect the interest rate exposure arising under that facility. There are quite a number of swap counterparties and different swap agreements. A few, and I stress a few only, of those agreements had a provision which enabled the counterparty, typically a bank, to close out those swaps at a certain fixed date. And we've had, I think, one of those before. We had two this year. We have one further one, although it's much smaller, less than $3 million, I think, current out-of-the-market position in 2016.
Yep.
But that's the extent of it. All of the other swaps do not have that unilateral right for the counterparty to terminate the swap.
Okay, thank you. That's very clear. One additional question. I mean, you just noticed the potential for Intervent to sell U.S. solar assets, and I was wondering if you could give us any additional color on that.
Yeah, thanks, Keith. You recall about 2 years ago we invested in a solar development pipeline and built up a team of people to pursue utility-scale solar PV development in the US. That has been a very successful initiative, and we have announced previously that the first two projects to come out of that development work are two 20-megawatt projects located in California. Those two projects have full planning approvals, and they also have long-term offtake contracts in place with Southern California Edison. They're the first two projects to come through the development pipeline. We've also mentioned that I guess we have a couple of different options in relation to those projects now they're in that state. One option is to sell them as they are. A second option is to build them and then sell them. And a third option would be to build them and keep them ourselves. Our view is that in the current environment, the most attractive option is to sell them as they are, in other words, as completed developments prior to construction, and we hope to have some favourable news on that shortly, but I can't provide any more information than that at this stage.
Okay, thank you very much. That's helpful. No other questions from my side this time.
Thanks, Keith.
Thank you. The next question comes from Robin Challis with RBS. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for the call. I was just wondering if there was any further update around the potential sale of Capital Wind Farm and how that process is going.
Thanks, Robin. Look, we announced that we did conduct some preliminary market testing around the possibility of a sale of Capital Wind Farm early last year. Given the, I guess, the coalition government's position on undertaking a further RET review this year, you would understand that investors and prospective purchasers for any of our assets are reluctant, really, to pursue that with any great vigour until there's much better regulatory certainty about the outcome of this review. And so that process is pretty much, ended as far as the preliminary market testing process is concerned. Of course, we could revisit that after the RET reviews are completed, but there's nothing to report on that at this stage.
Understood. Thank you. And just as a follow-up, you mentioned that forward prices are reflecting a no-carbon future. Is that now effectively seen as a 100% done deal that the carbon pricing will be removed?
I'd be cautious about saying it's 100%. It's considered, I think, in Australia to be the most likely scenario, but it is not yet clear whether or not the government will have the numbers in both houses of parliament in order to affect the repeal that they want to repeal. But most people, I think, would say it's highly likely.
And the timing of that, is that June, July? I can't remember.
The new Senate is due to take its position from 1 July, and the government has proposed to introduce legislation to repeal the carbon pricing mechanism in that month. And they've also indicated that they intend to introduce it in a way that would make it effective on 1 July 2014, notwithstanding the actual legislation won't be passed until after that date.
Okay, understood. Thank you.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time.
Okay, we'll just give a minute or so more. If anybody else has another question, that would be fine. If not, we'll be winding up the call.
Just a reminder, press star 1 to ask a question.
Okay, well, if there's no further questions, I'd just like to thank you for joining this call today. And as always, if you have questions, Pete, please feel free to call me or Richie Farrell in Sydney. Thank you.